Hello, this is Sue, and for the next half an hour, I will be reading from the May-June 2024 issue of the German Citizen on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On the cover, two farewells by Martin Ederer. It is worth noting the loss of two major anchors of German Buffalo. St. Anne Church, now for sure and for good. St. Anne Church now stands as a shell, having been stripped out. Some windows are now seriously damaged. The exquisite carvings, the altars, the pulpit, and other carved items and statues are gone. Most of these items and other fittings have appeared for sale on the King Richard's Literature Girl Design and Contracting website. This firm specializes in rescuing and reselling church fittings. King Richard is undoubtedly doing a brisk business from all the churches that have been shuttered in the Midwest, Great Lakes, and on the East Coast of the United States. While the rescue pieces from St. Anne Church may well find new homes, a big piece of our local German heritage has now been scattered and lost to us in the Buffalo area. Also, Scherer and Sons Furniture. One of Buffalo's last remaining German-American family businesses in its original neighborhood at 124 Genesee Street closed this past March after 127 years in business. Scherer's January press release, with edits and paraphrases here, noted that father and son co-owners Fred and Jim Scherer decided to retire after closing the doors of their business, which had been in the family for five generations and had been a staple in the Buffalo community since 1897. Our family has poured heart and soul into this business, and we're immensely grateful for the unwavering support of our community for an amazing 127 years, said Jim Scherer. Scherer's Furniture stood as a testament to the vision and dedication of its founder, Frederick Scherer, the first who laid the cornerstone of the company's legacy in 1897, when he began renting a small space in downtown Buffalo and opened what became the city's oldest furniture store. By 1939, Scherer's Furniture had outgrown its original location, and Frederick decided to move the business across the street into the building it occupied until earlier this year. Frederick passed down both his name and ownership of Scherer's Furniture to his son Frederick W. Scherer II, and then to his grandson Frederick Scherer III, who took over the family business in 1977. At 90 years old, Fred Scherer III still helped with store operations alongside his son Jim and granddaughter Kathleen. From the standpoint of German Buffalo that often gets overlooked, Scherer remained an anchor at Genesee Street and Oak Street as the neighborhood underwent the transition from a bustling German neighborhood to a struggling zone, and finally to a downtown fringe location near the Elm Oak Arterial. The quintessential family business, Scherer was noted for its high-quality furniture at competitive prices, holding its own against big-box stores in the suburbs. One could always feel the history in Scherer's showrooms. That was always a special part of the shopping experience there. Devin Lexton's Road to Dortmund with Buffalo Connections Along the Way by Julia Lexton. Before the story of Devin Lexton is to be understood, one must first know the history of his father, Steve Lexton, born in 1964, and bred in Devon County, Exeter, United Kingdom. Steve left England and moved to Buffalo, New York on an exchange program with a teacher friend on a whim, and also for better opportunities to chase his bodybuilding aspirations. This was in 1987. He was 23 years old, and he never ever returned to England to live again. Buffalo was his first entree into American life, and quite the experience it was. He learned everything he knows about American football there, and to this day speaks of his love for the kindness and welcoming nature of the Buffalo people as an impressionable young man alone in the United States. Steve only lived there 6 months before relocating to Florida, But 37 years later, he is the biggest Buffalo Bills fan on the planet, and his love and memories of his first experiences in America will forever be with him. Steve moved on to become Cobra on the American Gladiators, the TV show, in the late 1990s. Devin Luxton, born in 2004 in Jupiter, Florida, was a happy-go-lucky kid with artistic skills for drawing at an early age. His aspirations were to be the next Steven Spielberg and wanted to work for Pixar at 10 years old. Not one to ride bicycles, his father's other passion, nor playing organized American sports, Devin was happy creating and drawing, much like his mother Julie, a former professional dancer herself and interior designer. Seemingly not interested in organized sports, he took up golf and tennis, but not enough to take lessons. He did, however, enjoy watching the Buffalo Bills and learning all about football with his father, as the passion for the Bills bleeds red and blue in our house. At age 12, Devin decided he wanted to take ballet after seeing a regional road tour of the movie musical Billy Elliot. This was, of course, never on the radar for his parents, but as a family, mom, dad, and older sister Grace, they felt the need to see it through if this was indeed a real interest. Thankfully, right in their small town of Jupiter, Florida, was a most amazing French male ballet teacher who was trained at the Paris Opera Ballet. Devin took his first ballet class on his 12th birthday. The rest is history. 18 months later, Devin won first place in the Youth American Grand Prix YAGP, an international ballet scholarship competition at Lincoln Center in New York. He achieved this every year, making it to the YAGP finals in New York 5 years in a row. 10,000 dancers compete annually around the world, kind of like the Olympics of ballet, where 1,000 are invited to attend the finals in New York every year. His trajectory in the ballet world was swift and ever so exciting to watch. All the while in high school in West Palm Beach, Devin attended the Dreyfus School of the Arts, but not as a dance major, but as a digital media student, where he graduated in 2022. All of his training in ballet was at his local Jupiter dance studio, Paris Ballet and Dance, led by professional ballet dancer Jean Hughes Ferre. His summers were spent with additional training at the acceptance by auditions to the Royal Ballet School, the Dutch National Ballet School, the Paris Opera Ballet School, the Royal Danish Ballet School, and Princess Grace in Monaco, among many others. Meanwhile, his weekends from August to February were 1,000% committed to his favorite football team, the Buffalo Bills, of course. The Luxton family, including the dog, are all committed to their favorite team. Upon his high school graduation, Devin was invited to attend a 2-year training program with the Dutch National Ballet in Amsterdam. He will graduate in July of this year at age 20. After an insanely competitive and arduous audition season, just months ago, he was hoping to land his first professional ballet contract. Devin spent 6 weeks traveling the world, hoping to land his first job. Budapest, Barcelona, Stuttgart, Zurich, Dresden, Dortmund, Croatia, Czechoslovakia, New York City, Chicago, and more were all on the audition tour. Landing a position with a professional ballet company is akin to landing a professional sports contract, and I think he secretly would have rather played football for the Bills. About 2 to 5% of trained dancers actually make it to the fruition in the profession. Thankfully, Devin was offered 4 professional contracts both in Europe and in the USA. He chose Ballet Dortmund as the place he wanted to dive into his professional ballet career and is so very much looking forward to his move to Dortmund in July 2024. What a pleasant and serendipitous occasion to find out that Dortmund and Buffalo, New York are sister cities. It is kismet. Having seen the Buffalo statue in Dortmund, he began to question his symbolism, and lo and behold, Buffalo, New York, it is meant to be. Devin will be relocating to Dortmund in July of this year, upon his graduation from the Dutch National Ballet and is eager to make Dortmund his new home. Much like his father in 1987, moving to Buffalo, perhaps he will be learning all about the Borussia Dortmund football team and recreating his father's expatriate love of a foreign sports team, too, this time in Dortmund, Germany. Jacob Schokoff, Electrifying Buffalo. The Schokoff family story in Buffalo began with Jacob F. Schokoff from 1819 to 1899. Born in Kirchheim unter Tech in Württemberg, Schokoff trained to be a tanner in his father's business at age 14. After a five-year apprenticeship, he landed a job in Strasbourg. In 1841, he decided to go to America. His first stop was in New York, where he worked for 2 years before he moved to Buffalo. Schokoff's resume from there seems to reflect how well he understood America. Businesses were to be bought, improved, and then promptly sold at a profit. In 1844, he bought a tannery in Hamburg, New York. In 1846, he built a tannery in Buffalo. In 1848, he built a tannery in Milwaukee. In 1850, bought into a tannery in Chicago, and in 1852, he partnered up with another tannery operation in Buffalo. He also established a tannery in Fort Wayne and in North Evans, New York, and then he diversified into grain milling operations in Buffalo. He extended his grain milling business to Niagara Falls, and that led him to what really made the Schokoff family's fortune, hydroelectric power. Already for decades, entrepreneurs were enthralled with the power of the Niagara River as it approached the falls. A good number of factories, in fact, had been built on Goat Island long before any talk of a state nature preserve there. All he had hoped to capitalize on the free and seemingly endless power source the river could provide. The problem, however, was that same water power. The force of the river battered conventional wooden water wheels, which had glorious but short lifespans. Investor after investor tried to tame the river by building a hydraulic canal around the rapids above the falls. Construction was expensive. Business after business failed. Schokoff finally bought the thrice-failed canal project at auction in 1877. His Niagara Falls Hydraulic Power and Manufacturing Company finally completed the canal. His engineering of stronger turbines, along with their careful placement, finally made the canal commercially viable. As electrical technology was developing, Schokoff added a high electric power plant to provide DC power to his industrial operations in 1882. But it didn't take long for him to realize the bigger possibilities. Although other investors and competitors began to move in on Schokoff's hydroelectrical operations with improved technology and new ideas, the family's hydroelectric operations not only made the family's fortune, but also played a major role in electrifying America. The Schokoff family continued to hold major financial interests in what became the Niagara Falls Power Company in 1918, until a large part of the power plant collapsed into the river in 1956. That stated, Schokoff also played other major roles in the Western New York financial establishment. He served on the boards of the Buffalo German Insurance Company, the Merchant Bank of Buffalo, the German Bank of Buffalo, and the Farmers and Merchants National Bank. He served as a trustee for the Bank of Niagara, Power City Bank, and Buffalo General Hospital. For a time, he was president of Citizens Gas Company of Buffalo. Schokoff set up Schokoff Chemical and Dye Company for two of his sons. It bears mentioning as well that Schokoff had plenty of family in his family businesses, and he had seven children. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from The German Citizen on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Handy Guide to Berlin's History by Martin Ederer. The first impression a visitor gets of Berlin is its size and scale. The city is made up of 12 boroughs and occupies a huge footprint. There are cities within the city and also huge tracts of green space. It also ranks as the largest city in both Germany and within the European Union. Plainly put, over the course of the last few centuries, Berlin was laid out to be a world-class city, and it delivers. As European cities go, Berlin in Brandenburg is a fairly young city. First mentions of the city date to the 1200s, but a lot of history has taken place there, although we view Berlin as the quintessentially German capital. It had no such role as anything but a regional capital during the medieval First Reich. At that time, numerous capitals existed. Imperial diets routinely met at a whole list of cities, both inside and outside of what today is Germany. Berlin was Slavic origins. A good many neighborhood names reflect that heritage, with suffixes of OW or OW, its, ITZ, and ICHT, ITSCH. Earliest settlers included Slavic, Lusitanians, Wends, and Polabians. Then there were the German tribes, the Swabians and Burgens, who settled the region and became the dominant presence as Germans expanded their reach eastward, a long-standing medieval German project. By the 12th century, the Berlin region had become part of the Margraviate of Brandenburg, founded by the very German Albert, the Bear of the House of Anhalt. The earliest documentation of a settlement is mention of Spandau, now one of Berlin's boroughs, in the 1100s. The official founding date of the city is 1237, which quickly developed trade relationships across northern Europe from Bruges in Flanders to Novgorod in Russia. Meanwhile, Brandenburg was ruled in succession by members of the House of Luxembourg and by the House of Wittelsbach. The lion's share of the history of the region was dominated, however, by the House of Hohenzollern, Sigmaringen, those whose origins were well to the south and west in Swabia. They gained control of the region in 1411 by the mid-1600s, in addition to more western holdings. The House of Hohenzollern had gained the Duchy of Prussia and ruled a disjointed collection of territories. The 30 Years' War had devastated much of Central Europe, Brandenburg and Prussia included. Berlin lost 33% of its buildings and half its population. At this time, the Holy Roman Empire was a collection of some 300 small monarchies, duchies, and principalities cobbled together in a haphazard way. For all of them, the 30 Years' War was a hard lesson in what powerful national monarchies like France, Spain, Denmark, and Sweden were capable of. Rulers who hoped to compete in this new political world attempted to consolidate their hold on their territories, centralizing their power, raising taxes, and establishing national bureaucracies. The two most successful Central European powers in doing so were Austria and Brandenburg, Prussia. From that point forward, the story of Berlin was the story of the growth of the House of Hohenzollern, first as electors and later as kings of Brandenburg, Prussia. Berlin became the new kingdom's capital. Officially Lutheran, Brandenburg, Prussia promoted immigration and religious toleration, although some religious minorities still disagreed on how tolerant the kingdom was. When France tightened up restrictions on the Protestant Huguenots after 1585, Berlin became a prime destination for many of them. Once the elector, Frederick III, was granted the title of King in Prussia in 1701 for his service to the Holy Roman Emperor, Brandenburg, Prussia effectively became a kingdom. Berlin replaced Königsberg as the kingdom's new capital. Frederick the Great then embarked on big building projects for Berlin, as he also brought Enlightenment ideas to his capital. Russian forces briefly occupied the city during the Seven Years' War, and Napoleon's forces did the same in 1806. Prussia had become a major power to the 19th century. Berlin was incorporated into Brandenburg in 1815. The city grew prosperous as industrialization ramped up. In 1871, Berlin became the capital of newly unified Germany, the Second Reich. In 1881, Berlin became a district separate from Brandenburg. By the 20th century, Berlin had become one of the largest and most vibrant cities in Europe, with world-class architecture, parks, and cultural life. palaces, and monumental architecture abounded. The Reichstag building had become the legislative center of Germany. Wilhelm's II's Great Berlin Cathedral attempted to be a Protestant rival to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. In the city center, Museum Island became home to world-class museum collections. After World War I, Berlin was reorganized. Numerous surrounding towns were incorporated into the greater city. The city also became one of the major hubs of Weimar-era culture, technology, and modern art and architecture. By this time, Berlin was also home to a large and highly educated Jewish community. After Hitler came to power in 1933, Berlin became the center for much of the history of the 20th century, starting with the Reichstag fire and the ensuing Enabling Act. Hitler, together with Albert Speer, launched major plans to transform Berlin into world capital Germania. Berlin hosted the 1936 Summer Olympics. As Nazi Germany's capital, Berlin became the nerve center for the Nazi prison and camp system and some of the Nazi Germany's most famous atrocities, Allied bombings during World War II, and then the Soviet battle for Berlin in 1945 devastated the city. Well over 100,000 Berliners perished. Soviet forces brutalized the city's civilians. According to Allied agreement, Berlin was to be administered by each of the four major Allied powers, just as Allied-occupied Germany was. Berlin was to have Soviet, British, French, and American zones. These arrangements were also in place for Austria and Vienna, but Allied cooperation crumbled almost immediately after the war as disagreements between the Western Allies and the Soviets multiplied. The Cold War had begun. One result that was no peace treaty ever resulted for Germany, as eventually happened for Japan and the Pacific in 1951. The especially sticky issue was the economics. Was Germany to be a free market economy or a top-down Soviet communist economy? Most dicey of all was who would control the currency and how that struck at the heart of what sort of economy post-war Germany was to have, and fueled the disagreements between the Western Allies and the Soviets. As cooperation collapsed, the Western Allies and the Soviets each made their own arrangements for reconstructing Germany. That might have been satisfactory for the rest of the two Germanys, but Berlin could not have two economies and two currencies. As both sides vied for the dominant solution, the situation became an embarrassment to the Soviets when nobody wanted to use their currency. Stalin attempted to resolve the crisis in 1948 by blockading all Western access to Berlin, which was surrounded by the Soviet occupation zone anyway. The Western Allies, led by the United States, responded by patching up every heavy airplane in Europe and pressing them into service for Operation Vittles, better known as the Berlin Airlift. An air operation of this magnitude had never been attempted. Yet for more than a year, the airlift succeeded in supplying the western zones of Berlin. The Soviets were forced to relent. In 1949, both sides continued with their separate arrangements for the respective zones of Germany. The Western Allied zones became the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, its capital in Bonn. The Soviet zone became the German Democratic Republic, or East Germany. The Western zones of Berlin became West Berlin. The Soviet zone, which included the historic city center, was East Berlin. The Soviets also made East Berlin the capital of East Germany, a move that the Western Allies refused to recognize. By this time, an iron curtain, in the words of Winston Churchill, had descended upon Europe anyway. For Berliners, crossing checkpoints became a way of life. Checkpoint Charlie became the symbol of Berlin having become a divided city. In 1961, an especially tense period in the Cold War, the East German government began to build the Berlin Wall to physically and permanently separate East Berlin and West Berlin. Westerners were permitted entry into the East only after difficult crossing procedures and paperwork. Easterners were generally forbidden from crossing into the Western zones at all. In 1963, John F. Kennedy, in one of the most celebrated speeches of the Cold War, gave his Ich bin ein Berliner speech in West Berlin. I hope I got that right. The wall scarred the city and in some cases obliterated what were once busy urban landscapes, primarily among them the once vibrant Potsdamer Platz. In a later period of the Cold War, after Mikhail Gorbachev's glasnost and perestroika initiatives, Ronald Reagan challenged Gorbachev's new openness during his 1987 visit to Berlin. Here, Reagan made his famous "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall" speech in 1987 in the shadow of the wall and the Brandenburg Gate. In 1989, as the Soviets lost control of their Warsaw Pact allies, the Berlin Wall was breached, and Berlin was reunited the following year, as was Germany. Berlin was subsequently restored as the capital of Germany. A lot of history, not all good, but all of it fascinating. But all of it fascinating unfolded in a city well worth exploring. German Americans you should know about, Fred and August Duesenberg. The Duesenberg name has become synonymous with some of the finest automobiles ever produced, thanks to Gary Cooper and Clark Gable, who both own Duesenberg model SSJs. And the Duesenberg name came to be associated with Hollywood A-listers. While the Duesenberg brothers excelled at innovation and quality, the business side lagged. The onset of the Great Depression didn't help either. Eventually, the two brothers started designing internal combustion engines for building motorcycles. They opened two bicycle repair shops in succession after 1900 that failed rather quickly, the second venture because August had taken a job elsewhere in 1903. Their separation did not last long thanks to Edward Mason's offer to Fred for them to design and build automobiles in 1906. The Mason Motor Car Company reorganized after Fred Maytag had bought a controlling interest in the company in 1909 and renamed it the Maytag Mason Motor Company. Maytag, who also had German family roots, already enjoyed commercial success with his washing machine and appliance business. The Duesenberg brothers started designing reliable and powerful two-cylinder and four-cylinder engines. They also understood that entering their Maytag Mason cars and races was a way to advertise them. The plan seemed not to work for long, and Fred drove one of his cars into a fence. By 1910, the Duesenberg partnership with Maytag Mason was all but over, and the Duesenberg brothers concentrated on engine design in their own shop. The partnership formally dissolved in 1912, and the following year they moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. And in that same year, they established the Duesenberg Motor Company. But finally, by the time Fred was gone and he had died in 1932, August and his nephew mainly concentrated on racing and tried to keep the Duesenberg legacy alive until August's death in 1955. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the May-June issue of the German Citizen. Your reader has been Sue, and thank you for listening.